Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a Friday conversation about a new summer read, a memoir of being 16, pregnant, and shunned in a small New England town. But first, twists in the story of that Atlanta man with a drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis, who was told by health officials not to return to the U.S. from his honeymoon in Italy, but to get immediate health care. Reportedly, a border guard in New York allowed Andrew Speaker, a 31-year-old attorney, to re-enter the U.S. by car from Canada, despite an order from the Centers for Disease Control to detain him, because the border guard thought Speaker didn't look sick. Congress plans hearings on that incident. Meanwhile, Andrew Speaker appeared on Good Morning America today wearing a mask. He apologized to fellow airline passengers. But we also learned that his new wife has an 8-year-old daughter who was traveling with them as they traveled. Well, Robert Block follows Homeland Security issues for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us. And Bobby, how did Speaker cross that border in New York?
What actually ended up happening is everyone expected him first to come back through Atlanta because they identified that he had a return ticket for June 4th coming back to Atlanta. So it seems that a lot of the preparations, while all of the customs border posts, airports, land ports, and seaports were notified, they were really thinking that he was going to come back to Atlanta. So lo and behold, he did an end run around the manhunt by flying from Rome to Prague and then to Montreal and then deciding to drive back in the U.S. So it was a kind of surprise. He comes to the border. The passport is swiped, and on the man's computer screen, the agent's computer screen, the flagged records and the warning comes. And what appears to have happened is the border agent looked at the guy. He looked perfectly healthy and waved him through. In the end, it turns out the man spent less than 2 minutes at that border station before proceeding on to New York, where he was eventually voluntarily put himself into a hospital and into a CDC quarantine.
Someone would say, how can that be? Are border guards not aware that people may be carrying infections but still be healthy?
We've known since SARS, at least the Department of Homeland Security has known since the SARS threat of a few years ago, that border agents really don't have the professional and emotional expertise and training to deal with sick people, identify them. But the bigger problem is, before this happened, the CDC had identified this man. They knew he was in Rome. They had talked to him 5 times, telling him, don't go anywhere. One of the questions is, if we knew where he was, if the situation was so serious, why did we not work with the Italian government to basically quarantine him there? So, I mean, yes, the border guard failed. It is a major, it raises very serious questions about our security. But it also raises questions about the state of our public health, surveillance, and action when it comes to these kinds of diseases.
There's another odd twist in the story. This man's father-in-law, remember he had just been married, so his new father-in-law is Robert Cooksey, a microbiologist who works in the CDC's Division of Tuberculosis Elimination. Mr. Cooksey, the father-in-law, is saying that his new son-in-law could not have picked up this strain of tuberculosis from him. But, you know, it also raises questions about, you'd think that a son-in-law would ask his father-in-law, if he had that expertise, what to do.
It makes it that this was just not an average Joe citizen with a disease running around. It was someone who was inside, so he was known to the system, which may answer the question earlier why the CDC did move against him, because they felt that they could count on his voluntary cooperation. The Canadian Health Ministry, or the man in charge of their public health sector emergency response, he had a very different assessment when he talked to journalists the other day. He was saying that while the risk of this, the transmission of this disease is zero, it's actually very low. And he was not alarmed by the fact that this man had landed in an airport in Canada and had traversed the country. He seemed to play down the threat more than U.S. authorities had.
Quick closing thought, Bobby Block. Perhaps the question being raised here is not the damage that Mr. Speaker might have done if he wasn't as infectious, perhaps, as U.S. officials feel, but what he revealed about the Homeland Security system.
What this exposed is that we've excluded public health from our national security concerns, and I think for that reason alone, it's very worrying.
Bobby Block, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and also author of Disaster, Hurricane Katrina and the Failures of Homeland Security. Bobby, thank you.
Thanks.
Adoption. It's a valued way of helping women who, for whatever the reason, can't raise their biological children, and other parents who desperately want to take those children in. But for Meredith Hall, adoption was not a choice. In 1965, she was 16, a good girl from a good family that had suddenly ruptured with divorce. Soon after, she was pregnant, kicked out of school in New Hampshire, and shunned, her baby snatched from her at birth.
I struggle to reckon with my own silence, my lack of fight. I allowed my family and community to abandon me when I was drowning. Worst of all, I allowed my baby to be abandoned. I never said a word. Sometimes my own failure of courage feels like the most hideous kind of cowardice, a flaw in me that confirms my unworthiness for love. Sometimes, rarely, I get a flicker of understanding and feel a powerful protectiveness of that stunned and desperate girl. It is a function of shunning that it must eliminate the shunned completely. It feels like a murder and is baffling because there is no grave. No hymns were sung to ease my going or to beg for God's blessing on my soul. Shunning is as precise as a scalpel, an absolute excision, leaving, miraculously, not a trace of a scar on the community body. The scarring is left for the girl, an intense, debilitating wound that weeps for the rest of her life. It's quite a price to pay for having scared sex on a beach on a foggy Labor Day night.
Without a Map is Meredith Hall's memoir, dredging up the deprivation and grief she dragged around for decades. It's her first book, and she is here to tell us about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us more about this girl that you were.
I think that I was a girl who wanted to follow the rules. I wanted approval. I wanted to be a good girl. And I got that approval from my mother and certainly from my church and my school. I was an excellent student. I was a ballet dancer. And I was accustomed to doing well. I came from a family that had not attended college. I believed that I was going to be the first generation and go to an excellent school, and that would open the door to my future. Mm. And things went terribly wrong.
They did. But before that, I mean, I'm thinking of your mother as well, and this she creating this home for you. You sewed together. She taught you how to sew. That really stuck with me, you know, that everything seemed perfect. And then the day that you come home, kicked out of school, and tell your mother, and she says what?
I had gone to school that morning. I was 4.5 months pregnant and trying to hide one more day. And the school nurse finally caught me out and pulled me aside. And I was expelled, as girls were in the mid-60s. I was terrified, but I still didn't know exactly what I was expecting was going to happen.
Right.
My mother came home and she told me to call my father, and he came over from his house in a nearby town. And by the end of that conversation, it was clear that we were going to give up the baby, although I was not consulted on that. And my father asked my mother, now what? And my mother said, well, she can't stay here. And
that moment explodes off the page. What's happening in your young head?
There was a very dramatic severing that happened for me at that moment. And my mother's response was a complete surprise to me. I knew enough not to tell her, but I don't know what I thought she was going to do. Certainly, I didn't expect that she was going to kick me out. Mm. And I didn't expect that my father would take me in. He had remarried, and I did not have a relationship with him or his wife.
It wasn't exactly the best option. You were just kept in a room in this house while your dad and his new wife traveled, did their work. Right. You were some terrible embarrassment that was hidden away.
Yes. I think that I was typical of a girl in 1965. We brought so much shame to the family that we were, in fact, sent away and hidden away. Of course, I didn't know that. I didn't know that there was any other girl in the world who was in my situation or had done what I had done, was as shameful as I was. What I knew was that everything I had known was gone now.
What were you feeling from people, from friends? You know, people were crossing the street if you saw them, not to see you.
Yes, there was a great community shunning, and it's quite a phenomenon. There was no one who stepped forward and said, I will not behave in that way.
Worse than that, there is a doctor who pretty much said, you know, you're a bad girl.
Yes, he did. He said very clearly, you're a bad girl, and don't you try to tell me who the father of this baby is. We know that girls like you never know. It was a very, very... And he treated me and my body through that pregnancy and delivery with just that message, that I was so filthy and so contaminated that I deserved really nothing from him.
You then go off on this numb journey without a map, as the book says. You have one or two relationships, attempt to go to college, and end up deciding to walk from Britain to India. And it's this sort of biblical, you end up barefoot, starving, mute, because you don't speak the language, in the middle of Lebanon. What was that about?
It was a very reckless act. A friend of mine calls it my suicide walk. And in many ways, you know, by then, this was a few years. My child was 5 years old by the time this happened.
And by the way, you're thinking that every day. You're thinking, how old is my child?
How old is my child and where is my child? Mm-hmm. But by now, I had lost my mother's love and protection. And I had lost this baby into this great void, this absolute silence, as if none of it had ever happened and as if he didn't exist. And then along the way, because of trouble with my stepmother, I was forbidden when I was 19 years old to ever return to my father's home. And it was that final abandonment that really pushed me, I think, over the edge into this recklessness. And I left on that wandering feeling that there was absolutely nothing that could harm me. I was not afraid of anything.
Well, and you might have been guarded by something, because it's astonishing you weren't harmed. Here you are, this blonde American. You are fed from a goat by one Arab. A woman who is breastfeeding a child calls you over and gives you some of her milk.
Right. When I wrote that chapter, a friend commented afterwards when she read it, I love the way milk is working in this chapter.
Well, you were looking for a mother.
And I was astonished. I had no idea that I had written milk into the chapter. And I see now that, in fact, I had discovered both the father's love, this old shepherd who offered me sustenance and kindness, and then literally the mother's milk. I see why these are memories that I've carried with me all these years.
That's Meredith Hall, author of Without a Map, her story of trying to navigate her pregnancy as a 16-year-old in the 60s, well, without a map. When we come back, what happened to that son she was forced to give up for adoption in 1965? We'll continue her story. Quick note, though, later in the program, how the presidential candidates are using the internet and social networking. Forget MySpace. Barack Obama has created sort of Obama space. That's later today. We'll be back after a quick break with more from Meredith Hall, Here and Now. Robert Young, it's Here and Now. We're back with Meredith Hall, telling her story of being a scared 16-year-old in the 60s, forced to give up her baby for adoption. Let's fast forward 21 years. At this point in your story, you have two more children you're raising. You're living a normal life in New England. Suddenly, out of nowhere, someone knocks on the door. It's a 21-year-old young man named Paul. Now, to remind ourselves, for many girls, adoption is a lifesaver. Someone will raise the child they can't. But for you, it wasn't even a choice. You were just told he'd have a better life. What a shock, then, when that knock came at your door.
Yes. I think every girl who gives up a baby into adoption waits and believes that they're going to find this child, that somehow this child is going to return to their lives. But in that time, a girl was told that she absolutely must never contact this child, that she would destroy the child. It would be the ultimate. Not only did you do this horrible thing in having this child, but it would be the worst kind of betrayal and harm to try to find the child. And so I didn't do that, and I regret it very much. In fact, My son, when he was 21, worked through the New Hampshire court system and was given access to me, and he did come and find me, and we forged a relationship. I had two younger sons, significantly younger, and he has had the courage to join our family.
And you forged this wonderful relationship. He's determined to have you in his life, even though it's painful for him to see that you have these two other children and he didn't have the life they had. And it's excruciating for you to discover that this boy that you dreamed was on a horse farm somewhere in Virginia, as the doctor told you, back to the doctor, had a terrible life of abuse, poverty.
In fact, he was adopted. This was a private adoption, so my doctor had full control over these decisions. And he allowed my baby to be adopted by a couple in my father's small New Hampshire
town. He's right there.
He was right there. And it was a very, very difficult life for my son. There was abuse and extreme poverty, and it was a very, very bad environment for him.
Yeah, you get to know this family and forgive them. An abusive father who didn't know any other way. They were French Canadian, I think,
yes.
And they were farmers.
Right.
They both came from huge families. They were not educated. They were sort of acting out the stories that had been in their families.
Right.
And your son, when he was small, was beaten. He worked.
Yes, he was. He was overworked. Worked like a man. Worked hard on this very, very poor farm.
His mother couldn't protect him?
No, his mother loved him very, very much, but she was not able to protect her children. And by the time I met them, my son's adopted father had changed and was a kind of beaten old man. And his mother was filled with regret. And we did forge a very kind and tender relationship built on our mutual failures to this child. Hmm. We all failed this child.
Hmm. Did he say to you, why did you give me up? I mean, was it that clear?
No, never why did you give me up. But there was certainly a lot of searching for identity, because the life he would have lived with me would have been so different from the life that he actually lived. So there was a lot of questioning for him of what the implications are. How is identity formed, and what does it mean that he was dropped into this very, very strange family environment that was deeply formative for him?
Running parallel to this is another story. You, as you said, became a mother, and then a mother to your mother. Your mother starts dying a very painful death from
multiple sclerosis.
And you make note of a certain point that she had become so needy that the time had passed for any kind of reckoning,
yes,
of what had happened between the two of you. So you never,
yes,
had that kind of, how could you do that to me?
No, and I waited, you know. I became her caregiver along with my siblings when she got the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. I was in my early 20s. And so this was a dramatic shift. We had come through this very bad time and had certainly not spoken of it, let alone resolved it. And suddenly here she was with multiple sclerosis, and I understood immediately that she was dying and that I needed to step in and be a good daughter. Well, it took many, many, many years for her to die of multiple sclerosis, which I didn't know. It gave us plenty of time to undo some of that harm and make it right. And that never happened. We became very close, and I loved her very much, and I felt loved by her, but she never again felt like my mother. That ended the moment she told me to leave the house when I was 16 and in such trouble. I tried to be deeply caring and deeply protective, but I felt angry, and I had to wrestle with that throughout her illness, waiting for her to step forward and make this right in some way, to mention it even, to bring it up and say, maybe I didn't handle that in the way I should have. But it never did come up.
And your father, you had one meeting with him in a parking lot.
Yes.
Do you forgive them? Do you understand why they did it?
Yes. I think that forgiveness is very tricky territory, because it suggests a victim, and that victim coming back with some sort of grand gesture and bestowing something from the heart, and I'm very uncomfortable with it. Mm. I think instead the process for me has been one of recognizing human imperfection, and that love can be deep and even profound and still fail us. So the process for me has been one of understanding that those failures of love, in spite of costing me a great deal, are in fact the structure. They're the webbing of my life. Hmm.
Did they ever get to meet their grandchild, your oldest son?
Yes, they both did, in fact, meet him. And there was some measure of welcoming on the part of both of them. Perhaps not perfect, but some.
Oh, their loss.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, Without a Map is Meredith Hall's memoir, the story of giving up a child at the age of 16 and then meeting him when he was 21 years later and now forging a relationship with him. It's an unbelievable read. Thanks so much for coming and tell us about it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, still ahead today, a former Gitmo detainee on news that another suicide has occurred at that camp. Back after the news here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Aides to potential presidential candidate and actor Fred Thompson say he will formally enter the race over the July 4th holiday. Well, polls show the Tennessee Republican is already a top-tier GOP candidate. And these days, there's an additional barometer of political success. It's being called the Internet primary. Today's Wall Street Journal reports that on the social networking site MySpace, a Fred Thompson page already has more than 4,100 friends, just behind Rudy Giuliani's 4,900. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Wall Street Journal reporter Amy Schatz, who's been covering the online politics of the 2008 presidential campaign. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, and we're noticing as well, Fred Thompson has 7 pages, not just one. And to remind ourselves, ordinary people have pages and then friends join them on the page. But this is a candidate, and the joiners are supporters. Who sets these pages up?
These are just fans of Fred Thompson, basically. The man already has, I think, something like 50 blogs that are part of this Fred Thompson blog network, which are devoted to simply just talking about what Fred's doing every day,
yeah.
To the extent that they can figure out what he's doing every day.
Now,
he has tremendous support online.
Now, are some of these blogs and pages, though, set up also by campaigns?
Sure, and all of the campaigns are focusing heavily on the Internet this year, partly because it helps them raise money, because it helps them get new supporters, but also because, you know, it's a really long primary season. It started really early this year, and this gives them something to talk about.
And plus, they're all kind of looking in the rearview mirror and noticing how Howard Dean,
right,
really started all of this.
Everybody saw what happened with Howard Dean back in 2004, and while he didn't win, he did raise an enormous amount of money online, and he did have an enormous number of very dedicated, passionate supporters.
Mm. Okay, let's talk about what Barack Obama has done, because he seems to have taken this a step further. Instead of joining MySpace, he has made, you know, Barack Space.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, Barack Obama and John Edwards, actually, to a certain extent, too, has really gone a little bit further to try to come up with ways on a website that allows their supporters to actually talk to each other and support him without the campaign's help. And so while Barack Obama is on Facebook and MySpace and, you know, they talk about him on the blogs and he has a lot of online supporters, a lot of what they're doing inside the campaign is focusing on this site that they've got called MyBarackObama.com, which really gives all of their supporters a chance to sign up, give money, figure out where events are happening in their community, set up events, and, you know, figure out when actually he's coming to their community so they can go see him.
And as you write, the genius behind the site is none other than the 23-year-old co-founder of Facebook. This is Chris Hughes, who helped start the site while he was at Harvard with a couple of his roommates. He graduated last year. He was working full-time for Facebook. And suddenly here he is working 14 hours a day, we understand, helping to run the Barack Obama site. How did that happen?
This is a really interesting story. He was at Facebook last year when Barack Obama's Senate Internet director called and said that, you know, Obama really wanted to have a profile, official profile on Facebook. And Chris helped them do that, stayed in touch with the campaign, And when Obama officially launched in February, Chris called him up, and they met, and he signed on to basically take over the social networking part, because it really allows people to connect in different ways that they've never really had before.
Tell us about some of those ways. We understand there's an interactive mashup map, answer centers, but what is actually happening?
Well, it's just basically, it's taking all of the tools that Howard Dean used back in 2004, and it brings them all into one site, right? So it's like a one-stop shop. So instead of having to go to meetup.com to schedule a meeting and going to Evite to, invite people to your meeting, or, using an email list to try to get in touch with people, everything is all involved in one. And so on the website, you can search by zip code, and so you can figure out, who has groups supporting Barack Obama in my area, according to my special interests. Like, they have females for Barack Obama, they've got, smokers, or, people trying to quit smoking for Barack Obama, and you can join all these various different groups. And when you do that, you sort of start your own list, and you can sort of communicate back and forth and plan events. And, they've done a lot of fundraisers so far on this. One of the reasons why he's been getting so many crowds across the country is because people are logging on to this site and figuring out where he's going to be, and they're inviting their friends, and they're really starting to bump up the numbers on the number of people who actually come out to his official campaign events.
I'm seeing that there's, for instance, you talk about fundraising, there's a section where supporters can set a fundraising goal, and there's a thermometer that rises, and they can ask their friends to help them reach that goal. How much money are they raising?
They raised, I think it was something like $7 or $8 million online in the first quarter. And, I think he only raised like 22 total. So it was a huge part. It was more than a quarter of his total fundraising total came from online donations. And the great thing about that for a campaign is that the people who are donating online don't max out their contributions the way that people who go to big fancy dinners do. Mm. So if you go to a big fancy dinner, it's $1,000 a ticket. You can only go to a couple of those and you can't give anymore. For the people giving online, it's almost easier than buying a book on Amazon now, where, you literally just put your credit card number in, click a few buttons, and you're done. It is incredibly easy, and these people are giving like 25, 50 bucks, 100 bucks at a time.
Within the restrictions.
The campaign can go back to them at multiple times throughout to ask them for more money.
Well, with this idea of, how much the campaigns have gone online, there have been problems with bloggers. John Edwards had to fire some internet staffers who wrote some controversial things. It's a loss of control. The campaign, loses some control by doing this. And Chris Hughes, the Facebook founder who's now with Barack Obama, had to get one of Senator Obama's earliest volunteers to stop, and that raised a lot of hackles. There was somebody doing an independent site that had, almost 200,000 people logging onto it, and the campaign said, wait a second, we can't have these sort of rogue sites.
Yeah, this was a nasty, nasty little tussle that is really indicative of what's going to be happening more. Basically, what happened was about a couple weeks ago, the campaign got very nervous about their official MySpace page, which this volunteer from Los Angeles had set up a couple years ago. It started as an unofficial page, and then they made it the official page.
Who did?
The Obama campaign.
Ah.
And they got really concerned about this page because at some point they got into a fight with the guy, and he changed the password so they couldn't actually log on to the MySpace page anymore. So they basically had 160,000 supporters on a page that they couldn't actually formally contact, and then at some point they yanked the control away from him.
Hmm. So, Amy Schatz, you're calling this whole online world the internet primary. Who do you think's winning?
It depends on what your metrics are. So, you could look at who's raising the most money online. I mean, arguably, in some ways, it's Mitt Romney, because he's put a good chunk of his fundraising operation online. So he's doing pretty well. I mean, if you look at the total number of views on Facebook and all this other stuff, Obama's clearly winning. But, on the Republican side, too, one of the candidates who has the most support is Libertarian Ron Paul of Texas. Not clear that he's going to do particularly well in any sort of the more traditional metrics like, Iowa straw polls, things like that. But the man has tremendous support online.
Hmm. Amy Schatz, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, a former Gitmo detainee. And then before we go, artist Hassan Elahi. After 9/11, the FBI mistakenly detained him. He decided to avoid future detentions by telling the whole world what he's doing every second. You're listening to Here and Now. U.S. military records show that a detainee found dead in his cell at Guantanamo Bay on Wednesday was a Saudi Army veteran who once trained with U.S. forces before fighting against them in Afghanistan in 2001. U.S. officials say 34-year-old Abdulrahman Mata Al-Amri committed suicide, but they haven't released details of his death. Well, Mohsen Beg is a 38-year-old British Muslim who was also detained at Guantanamo for 2 years before being released. Mohsen was never charged with a crime, but the Defense Department maintains they were justified in detaining him. Well, Mohsen joins us now with thoughts on the Gitmo suicide. Mohsen, did you know Abdul Al-Amri?
No, I didn't know him. Perhaps I might know him by face if I see his picture, but it hasn't been released yet. I've spoken to a former detainee, Bishr al-Rawi, who was released a few weeks ago, who did know him, and he said that Mr. Amri had been on hunger strike for quite some time. He'd been strongly protesting against the conditions because of what was taking place, that they'd not been charged, they'd not been given any access to lawyers and so forth. I think that's quite an interesting one, because I think Mr. Amri didn't have any legal access, whereas some others did. And the fact that he was held in Camp 5, which is a super maximum security detention facility that was built just a couple of years ago, and where the conditions have been described by visiting lawyers as atrocious. So I think that perhaps it's a combination of being on hunger strike and being weakened that may have led to his death. The sad thing, of course, is that even after the last deaths that took place in Guantanamo of detainees, the three that died, we still haven't had an autopsy report after 1 year. And so people now are beginning to suspect that perhaps it's not suicide.
Mr. Al-Amri apparently never disagreed with the accusation that he was fighting in Afghanistan. He did say, though, that he thought he was on jihad, according to papers that have been released, that he didn't feel as much that he was fighting U.S. forces because, of course, he fought alongside them at one point. He was fighting an invader in Afghanistan. What do you say, though, to people who might say, well, but he was fighting against U.S. forces? I don't have much sympathy about the way he was kept.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that I don't know the details of his case completely, but he says, from what I understand, that he was there before September the 11th and that he came shortly after it, i.e. to fight what he believed to be an occupier. And just on the term of jihad, let's remember that the United States of America supported jihad when it suited it against the Soviet Union. They supplied Stinger anti-aircraft missiles and whatever to the Mujahideen, and the word Mujahideen comes from the word jihad. So I think it's important to recognize that. But as far as him, whether he was fighting against the United States of America or not, and none of that has ever been proved. It's never been shown through any Article 5 Geneva Convention hearings, and even if he was, then he would have to be treated as a prisoner of war. To label him as a terrorist and somebody who has no rights at all is really the height of unintelligence, because all it does is produce more anger and antipathy towards the United States.
Mohsen Beg, I just want to ask you about your time at Guantanamo, because you describe every waking day in Guantanamo as a slow death. But you also write that you forged relationships with the guards. One of them brought you a Cadbury cream egg from the area where you lived in England, and another gave you the book Catch-22.
Yeah, indeed, that's true.
How would you sum it up? It sounded, you know, like a hellish existence, but also one in which you had friendships with the American guards.
Well, you know, human beings are complex creatures. To intrinsically say somebody is totally evil or somebody is completely good would again be disingenuous. And I think everybody would say, if things weren't so politicized, that they were decent guards. There were decent, even some decent interrogators who were in Guantanamo who didn't agree with what was taking place at all. And particularly because you're in solitary confinement, you can talk to people on a one-to-one basis where there is no peer pressure from other soldiers or detainees. And some of those soldiers, as I said, were not just friendly towards me. I considered some of them to be my friends to this day.
Well, and you spoke English, as opposed to, I'm assuming, some of the other people who are there. Are you surprised that someone might take their life there?
The reality for me was that people do think about it. People think about not wanting to wake up. People think about what is the only escape I can have from here. And I talk about sleep as being, a small version of escape. If you could extend that to a complete version of escape, it would have to be death, because that's the only way you could get out from there if you don't know if or ever you're going to be released from Guantanamo.
Mohsen Beg, former detainee at the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, also author of Enemy Combatant, A British Muslim's Journey to Guantanamo and Back. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, after a break, an American who decided to document every moment of his life so that he won't be detained. That's Here and Now. Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Google the name Hassan Elahi, H-A-S-A-N-E-L-A-H-I, and you'll get his website, Tracking Transients, where you'll see a Google satellite map with blinking red arrow indicating Elahi's location. Elahi is a globetrotting artist who teaches at Rutgers University. He was born in Bangladesh, but moved to the U.S. when he was young, and is a U.S. citizen. He's also an obsessive record keeper. Go deeper into his website, and you'll see that Elahi ate at Zippy's in Honolulu on March 16th. His credit card charges are listed. Pictures of his meals are featured, taken as all the photos are from Elahi's point of view. Why is he documenting his life? Well, as Elahi explained it to us recently, yes, it's partially art, but much of it grew out of what happened to him after the 9/11 attacks when he flew into Detroit from Europe.
I basically hand my passport over to the INS guy. He swipes it and completely just turns white and says, follow me, please, and walks me through a rat maze at the airport, and I end up in an INS detention facility.
Well, come to find out, owners of a storage facility told police that an Arab guy with explosives emptied his locker and fled after the attacks. And
exactly.
You had a locker at that storage facility.
Yeah, yeah, I did. And but at the same time, I'm not exactly Arab. My family is far from the Middle East as the Middle East as could be to possibly here. I've never had explosives, but then again, you know, we're operating under an assumption of paranoia here where, I guess, you know, if you look a little funny, you have a funny name, then you must be Arab.
Well, you, luckily, as someone writes, you're an obsessive scheduler, so you whip out your PDA and are able to show people, oh, I was doing an art exhibit at that
time.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, this was interesting because it was at the airport when I'm sitting in this huge room. This man in a suit comes straight up to me and looks at me and says, I expect you to be older. So he took me into a little, as they call it, interview room, but it's just like the movies, minus the dangling light. And he said, where were you? And we basically recounted everything. And I literally wrote, I had to pretty much justify everything down to the microsecond. So he let me go. I guess he had enough information for me because, I mean, I had all this records. I mean, every little detail of where I was at what time, what I was doing. And he says, well, I have enough information here. I'm going to pass this to the Tampa office. They're the ones that initiated this, and they'll follow up with you, and we'll get this sorted out. It went on for basically the next 6 months where I had to justify every second of my existence to the FBI. I mean, it's a very strange experience being, you know, so close to, well, essentially life and death. I mean, you know, I could have said, you know, this isn't legal. I'm getting a lawyer. But then again, I knew that at any moment they could have said, well, you know what? We're taking a Guantanamo. We don't have to tell you why. Mm-hmm. So I understood the power structure. So my only rational decision was to cooperate. And I told them everything.
And you were ultimately exonerated.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end, I asked them to give me a letter, but they said, no, we can't do that. Well, I guess, you know, how can I be formally cleared of something if I've never been formally charged with something?
Right.
So they said, well, do you when you travel, do you carry a cell phone? And they said, well, you know, here's some phone numbers. Call us and we'll take care of you. We'll make sure to get this straightened out.
So you've started this project and you have said that this is to keep you out of Guantanamo. Yes, it's art, but it's to keep you out of Guantanamo.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say how it started because it started in such an organic process. It started with a phone call to the FBI agent. I said, you know, I got to go this week. Okay, where are you going? Well, I'm going to Paris. Okay, what's your flight numbers? I give him my flight numbers. He says, okay, I got this taken care of. Okay. It went on from that to an email with pictures. Then I started thinking to myself, you know, why should only the FBI know where I am and what I'm doing? Why don't I just tell everybody? You know, the FBI, CIA, regardless of who the agency is, I mean, intelligence agencies all work in an industry where their currency and commodity is information. And, you know, I'm an information artist. I'm a media artist. So we're kind of in the same business.
And you've said that it's sort of you're borrowing an economic principle of flooding the market with so much information that you devalue it.
Exactly. My point is to devalue my file because, you know, I can't get access to it.
Do you think there might still be some officials who still doubt whether you're telling the truth, who are now finding themselves pouring through, for instance, your credit card statements and know that on March 10th you were at the Raceway in Highland Park, New Jersey, or on March 5th you were at the Chili's in Houston, Texas. At March 3rd, you drove on the New Jersey Turnpike. I mean, is part of this that perhaps you're overloading their system?
A really interesting thing happens because once you cross-reference all that financial data with the communication records, my cell phone records are public, and then there's a huge database of photographs that go with it. Once you cross-reference all of that, it has to be accurate. Sure, I can doctor up a little bit of the information here and there, and particularly with digital images, but you can't doctor up a sequence of 20,000 images because it'll take you more time than time
right.
exists within that time frame.
What else are you putting on your website?
My telephone records are there. The banking records are there.
Food?
I have everything that I've eaten, even down to every urinal that I've used. I mean, you know, my thing is, look, you know, I couldn't have possibly been involved in that terrorist attack because I was busy using this urinal at this moment in time that you say I was there.
And by the way, remember that it's a point of view.
Yes.
It's a camera point of view. But what makes that art, by the way?
Well, it's real. Well, you know, there's been historically, there's been a lot of work dealing with surveillance and dealing with documentation. But the thing that separates this from other works is the motivation. I mean, my motivation purely is to keep myself out of Guantanamo. And if that does take on the form of art, then that's how it's ended up.
I'm looking now at the page. I've clicked on one of the icons, and I'm looking at tracking transients' altitude. Here's mm-hmm. a picture from a collection of over 450 airline meals that you've eaten in the last few years, and it's actually quite pretty. It looks like a Dutch meal, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Well, it depends on which one you're looking at. You're probably looking at a KLM flight there.
Yeah.
But there's literally been, because I fly so frequently, I decided to document all my airline meals. Now,
I have to jump in again. Here's uh-huh. security and comfort. I've come to the collection of over 400 toilets. Now, side by side, mm-hmm. and it's sort of like a grid, a composite of all of these toilets. It's kind of pretty, actually. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. They actually do take on a really beautiful form, but at the same time, once you start looking at, well, why is he doing this? And I really hope that when a viewer is on my site, that they sense that something's not right, and maybe in the process of doing this, they go from playing the role of the investigator to basically saying to themselves, "Hey, this could be asked of me at any moment.
Right.
I could be the subject." And the way it's set up is that there's nowhere do you actually see my face, nowhere do you actually see my name, nowhere do you see something that really identifies me. Everything is relative and subjective to where I am, what mm-hmm. I'm doing, how I'm going about my life.
But I wonder if you think this is where we're all headed, you know, where, you know, to be safe. And also just a part of that sort of voyeuristic part of society, everybody's transactions, everyone's actions are going to be for public consumption?
Well, I don't think it's just for security. I think it's a culture. There's a generation that would write a letter. There's a generation that would make a phone call. There's another generation that would send an email message. And now we have a generation that's posting a MySpace message. So I think, you know, if it's not already there, it certainly is happening and it certainly will happen. And that's the direction that we're headed in.
Hassan Elahi, professor of art at Rutgers University. To get to his Tracking Transients website, you can go to ours, here-now.org. Hassan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.